Hello, and welcome to our micronutrients module on vitamin B7. Vitamin B7 is also known as biotin, and it's more commonly known as biotin, but rarely do we actually speak of vitamin B7 like we do of vitamin B12 or 6. All of the vitamins obviously have their own names, and some of them are just colloquially or casually called vitamin X, vitamin B, whatever, and the others, some of them are just called by their name. This one, I'll be going back and forth, mostly I'll call it biotin. So vitamin B7, biotin, same thing. So before we get too far along, I want to make sure that you're aware that the presentation is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, not intended as medical advice. It is intended as a sharing of my knowledge and my research and all my clinical experience to you, and it's not intended for you to dump the doctor's orders and go for it. And that's, again, what you want to be saying with your clients. And just so you know, this disclaimer has been updated by a lawyer, and it's so very official. So if you guys want to swipe copy it, feel free. You'll get copies of the presentation and use it in your own things. So I'll read it out loud. We encourage you to make your own healthcare decisions based upon your research and in partnership with a qualified healthcare professional. This presentation is provided for informational purposes only, and no guarantees, promises, representation, or warranties of any kind regarding specific or general benefits have been or will be made by Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, her affiliates or their officers, principals, representatives, agents, or employees. Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo is not responsible for and shall have no liability for any success or failure, acts and or omissions, the appropriateness of the participant's decisions, or the use of or reliance on this information. So, like I said, feel free to swipe the verbiage. It has been paid for and put together by an attorney, and I am not an attorney, so if you want to make sure that this works for you, you would have to consult your own attorney. So disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer. And we do this to protect the patient, the client, and also ourselves, because sometimes people just run away with, oh yeah, but she told me to do this. So we're not telling anybody to do anything. We're just basically providing information. I'm providing you information about these vitamins so that as you're working with your clients, you have a really good working understanding of the variety of the vitamins, what they do. I don't expect that you're going to memorize every single thing that I teach in every one of these. The tests at the end of each of the vitamins will be representative of what I think is the most important, and then the test at the end of the whole micronutrients module will be very clinical oriented of the stuff you want to be able to think about. Now, you're not going to memorize all this stuff. I don't want you to. Some of you may have photographic memories. More power to you. I don't. It's repetition that causes this to get memorized. And I don't have all the every little minute detail and of all the structure of these vitamins memorized. But it's familiar and you'll know where to look. So I want you to have a good working knowledge of this stuff so that as you're going through things with your clients, you know where to look. And we have tables as part of this module. There's a really nice table of the B vitamins, and there's tables of various things that you can print out and have a nice little notebook. So as you're assessing a client, you do an intake and they have specific presentations, you're trying to think, wow, are they showing some signs maybe of vitamin C deficiency or biotin deficiency? You know, some of the symptoms of a biotin deficiency might be similar to symptoms of adrenal fatigue. Right? And we'll talk about that, like hair loss, for example. But it helps you to be able to differentiate between the various things going on by the accumulation of how they're presenting. And so it helps you to be able to identify what foods, what nutrients, what herbs might be helpful for this person in order to facilitate balance. And what we're doing all along is supporting people to restore balance. That's it. We're not diagnosing, we're not treating ever, really. We're helping people to restore balance, and we're helping people to get away from the this for that approach. And I want you to get away from that too. What vitamin is good for this symptom? No vitamin is good for this symptom. It's what's out of balance and what can we do to restore balance. And so the beauty and the art of this whole process is being able to like pull all this stuff together and be able to go in a direction that might serve the person, whereas somebody who's not thinking along these lines is not going to come up with. So, a long story short, We're going to go to biotin today. So this is your roadmap to your B vitamins. B vitamins at a glance. It's a nice little table. It just has the names of the vitamins along with the numbers and then a few little notes about their actions just in a nutshell. Doesn't mean it's the whole thing, but it's a good way to look and kind of remember as they start to get muddy. Like, what does B9 do versus biotin versus, you know, versus B4, whatever. You've got this here to look for. And like I said, in the materials that accompany this module, there is a chart that lists all the B vitamins and goes into more detail this way. So biotin is where we're at now. This is the You Are Here, B7 biotin. The main functions are related to hair and metabolism. And we're going to take you deeper with that, and then you'll be able to come up to the surface and say, ah, now I understand why it's related to hair and how it's related to metabolism. So we've got vitamin B7 general information, okay? Biotin is sometimes known as B7, sometimes called biotin. Sometimes it's actually called vitamin H. Not so much anymore, but it used to be, and it was related to the German words for hair and skin that started with H. So started to refer to it as vitamin H. It's colorless, it's water soluble, and it's part of the B complex. It helps in the metabolism of proteins and also in the processing of glucose. And it's not one of the top nutrients we often think about in terms of glucose metabolism and insulin resistance. You know, we talk a lot about chromium and magnesium and DHA and lipoic acid and zinc, but biotin plays a big role, as do all the B vitamins. There are actually 8 different forms of biotin, but only one of them, called D-biotin, occurs naturally and has the full activity of the vitamin. It can only be synthesized by bacteria, molds, yeast, algae, and by certain plant species. So we can actually produce biotin within our body, but we cannot produce it. That's why it's considered a vitamin that's essential, an essential nutrient, because we personally can't make it, but it can be synthesized in our body if we have specific bacteria, molds, yeast, and algae. Okay, so animals cannot make it. So you're not going to see animal biotin found in animal products except for from the bacteria that are living in there. So let's look at structure. I always like to look at these things. I never memorize it, but it helps bit when you're recognizing it, the various chains and being able to see the difference. Some people are really into this spatial consideration. That's not my big thing, but I don't think it's clinically as relevant, but it's a good thing to know because you might be reading a specific study and they may find that particular pieces of the vitamin have activity and when they alter it, and drugs are usually based on the structure of a specific chemical. And we know from the difference between, say, estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone, which look very similar, they have a steroid ring, very few little differences, they have very huge functional differences. So when somebody says to you that, oh, I made this synthetic form of this, it just has a little extra side chain over here, you're questioning, does it really have the same biological activity? So biotin consists of 2 rings. One is called a uridine ring, and it's joined to what's called a thiophene ring. And then it has an additional valeric acid side chain. And I've got a picture where I show you what those things are. Biocytin, which is another of the active forms of biotin, consists of biotin bound to lysine, and it's sometimes called biotinylicin. Some of these words are difficult to pronounce, but you'll recognize them as you go through the literature on this stuff. So here's a picture of it. So this thing up at the top, right around here, is called the uridine ring. And that's got it's got some nitrogen in it, so it's got an NH and an NH on either side. It's got a double bond to an oxygen, and then it's got a bond that comes down to carbons, 2 carbons. Whenever there's no letter written there and you've got a ring like this, the unnamed ones are carbon. So that's what that ring looks like. That's bound to a thiophene ring, and that thiophene ring has sulfur included in it. So see the S there. So it's got some carbons, it's got some hydrogens, and it's got some sulfur. Okay, then we have this valeryl side chain, and that's got, all these are carbons, remember these lines, this 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, these are all carbons. got a double bond to oxygen, and then it's got an OH at the end, and OH is generally considered an alcohol group. Do you have to memorize this? No. But what you'll see as you see some activities here and maybe some studies on how it works, that some of this stuff becomes important. So there's a comparison of biotin versus biocytin. You can see that they're exactly the same, the blue part. And then in the orange part, this is where the lysine group is added on. And lysine is an amino acid. It's an essential amino acid. So how is biotin absorbed and digested in the body? Well, let's start with digestion. It's bound to protein. So it requires digestion by proteolytic enzymes. So any nutrient that is bound to a protein, whether it's a mineral, a vitamin, if it is bound to protein, it means that the person needs to have good proteolytic enzymes, protein digesting enzymes, to break it apart. And what that means is that they need to have good stomach acid to start that proteolysis. Okay, so that will yield, once you can break it away from the carrier, biotin, biocytin, or biotinyl peptides. So the biotinyl peptides are further broken down, hydrolyzed, so with the addition of water, by other proteases, right, protein digestion or peptidases within the small intestine. The biocytin is hydrolyzed by the enzyme biotinase on the intestinal brush border, right? The intestinal brush border is the, you know, the villi. And in pancreatic and or intestinal secretions. Okay, so all of this is happening in the intestine, the small intestine. So the enzyme, the biotinidase, hydrolyzes water breakdown, biocytin to release biotin and lysine. Okay, so if you've got the biotin coming in the form of the biocytin, it releases into biotin and then the amino acid lysine. Sometimes there's undigested biocytin that's absorbed intact by the peptide carriers and hydrolyzed, broken down, by the biotinase in the plasma and most body tissues. Not most of it, just some of it. There's also unmetabolized biocytin, which can be excreted in the urine. So it can be absorbed intact, taken through the intestinal, taken through the bloodstream, and then excreted in the urine by the kidney action. So let's look at the absorption. So the free biotin, you know, once it's extracted from its protein carrier, it's absorbed primarily in the jejunum and sometimes in the ileum. So we know that the jejunum is where most absorption happens, but we've seen with some other vitamins that sometimes they're absorbed in the duodenum further up and sometimes in the ileum further down. Good example of absorption in the ileum is primarily most of the B12 is absorbed in the ileum. Most of the biotin that we take in dietarily is completely absorbed. That's good news, isn't it? That's really good news because a lot of these vitamins and minerals we see there's a very small percentage of absorption, maybe 25%, maybe 50%, maybe 75%. So almost all of it is completely absorbed. And then it can be synthesized by the colonic bacteria. So you can take it in food, but also if you've got good gut bugs, which most people don't when they're coming to see us, right? That's absorbed in the proximal and mid-transverse colon. Okay, so the ascending and then across. So it's like close to the ileocecal valve, close to the small intestine. And these bacteria, you have to have good bacteria. It's not synthesized by the intestinal bacteria and not absorbed. So it's mostly by the colonic, so large intestine versus intestinal, and that's usually the differentiation when you see that. And it can be excreted in the feces. So any excess can be excreted in the feces, any stuff that's not absorbed can be excreted in the feces. What the bacteria in our guts make cannot totally meet our needs, no matter how good the gut bacteria are, okay? So we really do need to rely on external biotin, which is why it's considered a vitamin that's essential. So let's look at the mechanism of biotin absorption. And as we've looked at some of the other nutrients, we see that the absorption is either usually by passive transport or active transport. Passive transport is often called diffusion. And usually, which of these is favored has a lot to do with the gradient. And what do we mean by gradient? Well, we've got a certain amount of the nutrient in the intestinal lumen, and then a certain amount in the cells that are lining the enterocytes. And so if the amount that's in the intestinal lumen far exceeds what's in the cells, then passive transport happens. So things like to move from high concentration to low to kind of balance it out. Once they're closer to equal, we're requiring an energy transport, a protein carrier in the lining, in the membrane, in the enterocyte lining that will take the biotin from the lumen and carry it in. Generally, what that does is protect us from too much of a certain nutrient. Okay, so that's basically it. So passive diffusion occurs with what we call pharmacological doses. Pharmacological doses is you're taking huge amounts. And physiologic doses of biotin are more what you're going to get in food or in a normal, like a B-complex or a low kind of gradient or a low quantity biotin supplement. The absorption across that brush border membrane, we often call that the brush border membrane, occurs and across the colonocytes. Those are cells that line there. It's carrier mediated and sodium dependent. So in the normal amounts that we're getting in with food or that your clients are taking in with their food, we need this active transport. And that requires that the lining be intact, that it hasn't been damaged by inflammation, that there's not an extensive amount of leaky gut, because leaky gut causes inflammation, which can damage some of these proteins transporters. So some people think that, well, if the gut is leaky, wouldn't all these vitamins just pop in to the gut? But not necessarily, because of the gradient. So they require the active transport. And so what happens a lot of times when people have a leaky gut is that there's a passageway, a diffusion of things like larger molecules, like undigested proteins and say, you know, or partially digested proteins, peptides, and say toxins and bacteria and bacterial toxins, because the gradient is such that whatever's in the lumen is more than what's in the cells. So those pass on through, and they pass through easily when they're leaky gut. They won't pass through when the gut's intact, but once those pores get a little bit larger, those undesirable things pass through. But the other part of the coin is that the leaky gut and the inflammation will damage the carriers. And so the active transport decreases, so we don't get as much of our basic nutrients, our vitamins and minerals, et cetera, crossing through. And we think about the vitamins are big. They're not just single molecules. They're pretty big. They have a lot of different pieces to them. And they're sodium dependent also. There's oftentimes what's called the sodium potassium pump. So let's look at the storage of biotin. Do we store enough biotin? Is it stored like B12, where you have years of it in the liver? Is it stored like vitamin D or A or E or the fat solubles, where there's a good storage of it in the liver? Is it stored like iron, where there's a good storage in the liver? No, it's not. Very small quantities. So you can find it in most body cells, especially muscle, liver, and brain, but it's in small quantities. It just kind of metabolic goes around, it does its thing, and then it's excreted, as do most of the water solubles, the exception to that being vitamin B12, which is stored in larger amounts in the liver. In the plasma, it's mostly free and unbound, so it's not bound to any protein carriers, it's just free. There are smaller amounts that are bound to protein, and when they are, they're bound to proteins like albumin, alpha and beta globulins, and a specific one called biotinidase. So in the plasma, the biotinidase, and that would be a carrier. So we've got biotin, we're taking it in, and you're wondering if your client has a problem with biotin. Well, let's just look at, well, it looks like they're taking in plenty. They're getting good sources of it, but they have some deficiencies. So what's going on here? Well, there's certain things that decrease absorption. So if they're a smoker, that's going to decrease the absorption of their biotin. Canning of foods. So if the food had a lot of biotin to begin with, but then it's been canned, a lot of that biotin gets destroyed. There's a protein called avidin. And avidin is found in raw egg whites. It's considered a glycoprotein, and it binds to the biotin in what's called a non-covalent bond, and it's irreversible. That's what's critical here. So if someone is eating a lot of raw eggs, like there's Rocky, the movie Rocky, where they were throwing all these eggs into the blender and blending them up. Or when I was a kid, we used to drink what my mom called eggnogs for breakfast. She'd throw milk and eggs and sugar and chocolate in the blender, and we'd make it up. We'd blend it up. That egg white is binding biotin. Okay, probably didn't have much biotin in the food we were eating, so it didn't much matter. But nonetheless, if someone's eating a lot of raw egg whites, it's going to irreversibly bind their biotin. And it's going to prevent biotin from being absorbed. It's unstable with heat. So that's why it's in the raw egg whites. Once they make an omelet or whatever else you might make out of the egg, then that glycoprotein, that avidin, is going to be destroyed by the heat. So there's very little of it. Actually, it's not all that many. It's saying that two or more raw egg whites daily for longer than a few months could cause deficiency. Well, I was doing that for years as a kid. Seriously, we had that pretty much. That was our breakfast the whole time I was in elementary school. So almost every day, maybe occasionally we had eggs on the weekend or something, but that was the way we did it. That's how my mom got our eggs and protein in us first thing in the morning. So not a great idea. So the other things that interfere with biotin absorption are things that like gut problems, like lack of HCL is a big one. Any kind of issues where, like I said earlier, you've got a problem with leaky gut or inflammation where those protein carriers get destroyed. High dose vitamin B5, like pantothenic acid, can be problematic with biotin. So when I put people on a B5 supplement because they've got adrenal fatigue, I'd like to see us putting them on biotin along with it so that we don't get some of the issues that a deficiency of biotin could cause. Because we need the extra B5 a lot of times with adrenal fatigue. Yet if we end up letting them get deficient in biotin, hair loss, as we'll see in a little bit, is one of the symptoms of low biotin. But hair loss is one of the symptoms of adrenal fatigue. So we might be not seeing the hair loss get better if we're giving them the high dose B5, but not also supplementing them with biotin. Alcohol interferes, and alcohol is disruptive to digestion in general because it kind of thins the mucosal lining and makes it harder to produce HCL. Pregnancy decreases the absorption of biotin, so it's important to get more biotin during pregnancy. And then genetic defects, and we'll look at a couple of those, that just, you know, specific problems with the transport proteins. There's always genetic defects that can affect the absorption of pretty much anything. The kinds of things that increase biotin absorption, there's not a whole lot. Eating biotin-rich foods and extra supplementation. So there's not any particular thing you can take with your biotin that makes it absorb better. You know, like in contrast to, say, something like iron, where if you take iron with vitamin C, it increases the absorption. So let's look at some drug interactions. And the reason I always share the drug interactions with these nutrients is that when you're doing a history on your client, you want to make sure that you're getting a list of drugs, not only that they're on right now, but that they've been taking over the last few years, at least over the period of time during which some of the symptoms that they're concerned about have occurred. Because sometimes what happens is you have people who have been taking these medications, they get fed up with the medications, they decide that nutrition is the answer, and then they dump their medications and don't take them anymore. And they come to see you and you say, what medications are you on? And they say, none. So you have to go and ask the question, what many medications you've been on in the last few months? None. Okay, what about in the last couple of years? And then another question you always want to ask them, I always ask everybody, is when was the last time you were on antibiotics? How often are you on antibiotics? Some people will give the answer, I'm not very often. It's a similar answer to how well do you eat? Oh, I eat fine. How are your bowel movements? Oh, they're fine. You have to ask the right questions or you don't get the right answers. And people will just think it's fine to have 3 to 4 bowel movements a week. So when you say, how are your bowel movements? They say, fine, you move on. You haven't dug deep. So similar to, how often do you take antibiotics? Oh, not that often. Right? Then how often? When was the last time you took them? Oh, about 3 months ago. Oh, really? What did you take them for? And then you oftentimes get indications from their history of things they didn't even tell you about. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, I had a sinus infection. Yeah, I had that sinus infection for about 2 years, so I was on antibiotics every 3 months. What a difference that makes, right? So if somebody's been on antibiotics for a long time, off and on, they're going to have problems not just with biotin, but we've seen this with a lot of the other nutrients. So here's the thing with antibiotics and long-term use, right? They may be on like tetracycline for acne, or maybe they were on it as a teenager and now they're in their 20s and they don't even think to tell you about it because it was just an acne treatment, right? But a lot of times people are put on tetracycline for years straight, or someone had a lot of ear infections and they were on course after course after course. We want to know this, not just because of the gut interaction, which is the main thing, like what's it done to their gut flora, their microbiome, but also because of the interaction with lots of these medications. So biotin and antibiotics, not a good combination. And then there's a group of anti-seizure medications that interfere with biotin. And it's important to ask about these because, like antibiotics, more so than antibiotics, anti-seizure medications are usually things people are on for a long time, right? If somebody's found to have seizures when they're 12 years old, they put them on the medication. Oftentimes they just don't get off the medication because mom is afraid to take them off, or the doctor's afraid to take them off for fear they go back into seizures. So really important to do a good drug history whenever we're looking to look at the medication, the nutrient status. Okay, so let's look at biotin and what it does in the body. So like most of the B vitamins, it has a role as a coenzyme. So it has some functions that are not related to being a coenzyme, but it has functions that are related to being a coenzyme. And a coenzyme is basically a bosom buddy of an enzyme. It helps to speed up the reaction of an enzyme. So if you've got an enzyme that takes something from point A to point B, without the coenzyme, it might take, you know, X amount of time to get from point A to point B. When you add the coenzyme in, it might take X divided by 100, you know, so it's a much quicker reaction. So biotin has some cofactor roles. And so sometimes you'll hear us call them cofactors versus coenzyme. Coenzyme is actually more accurate because that's how they're functioning, but sometimes they're called cofactors. When biotin is acting in its cofactor role, those enzymes are called holoenzymes or holoenzyme carboxylases. So there are four of them. So biotin is covalently bound to four apocarboxylases, four different ones, and you've got four different coenzymes. They're synthesized by a specific enzyme. Right? Everything seems to happen by enzymes, right? Holocarboxylase synthetase. It occurs in the cytosol, the cell, the gooey stuff inside the cell, and also in the mitochondria of the cell. So there's a two-step process. Okay? Biotin reacts with ATP in a magnesium-dependent reaction to form this biotinyl adenosine monophosphate and pyrophosphate. Okay? Do you need to remember all that? No, just giving you that stuff, right? But whenever we're creating these coenzyme forms of biotin, it requires ATP to create it. So it requires energy to create it. So it's just, I like you to think, right? So I'm thinking, so if to create a coenzyme form of a particular vitamin requires ATP, what happens if you've got somebody who's exhausted or has mitochondrial dysfunction, or is deficient in some of those nutrients that we shared in our cellular metabolism module that help you create ATP? So there's or deficient in oxygen. They're not breathing properly. They're having some problems with lung and diffusion. So vitamin and mineral deficiencies, especially vitamins that act as cofactors, can have a lot of underlying causes. And that's why it's so important to do a really, really thorough case history. So the activated biotin reacts with the apocarboxylase to form a holoenzyme carboxylase and the release of AMP. And that's part of that Krebs cycle. Deficiencies of the carboxylases can also be due to genetic mutations. So I don't know the particular SNPs. We could probably do a search. There's so many databases out there to look up the specific genes. I'm not sure if they're ones that are shown on 23andMe, but that's something that if that's of interest to you, you can certainly look into. So let's look at function. So we're going to do some pictures, some biochemical pathways, and this just shows you how that process happens, how the biotin gets biotinylated and the carboxylases are added to form the carboxylase. Okay, it requires the ATP. You can see that here. And it goes from the apocarboxylase to a holocarboxylase. So biotin gets recycled. So we get the biotin from the diet. We get the biotin from the microbiota that are producing it, assuming that we have that. And so you take that biotin and you add the apocarboxylase using that holocarboxylase synthesis, forms a holocarboxylase, and then it's added on and it's converted to biotin-linked oligopeptides. So oligopeptides meaning short chains of amino acids. A dipeptide is two amino acids, just a review from our macronutrients. An amino acid, a dipeptide, a tripeptide, an oligopeptide. Oligo is some short chain, somewhere between like 3 and 10. And it gets converted to the biotin, and then using the biotinase takes the lysine off and goes back to biotin. So we can recycle the biotin when we no longer need that coenzyme form in a reaction. So here's some of the biotin-dependent enzymes. Remember I said there were four, and we've made a little chart for you. And a lot of this stuff comes from the textbook that we recommended. So if you want to go back and go, you know, review a lot of this stuff, you'll see some of it there. You start with this. One of them is pyruvate carboxylase, which converts pyruvate to oxaloacetate, and that's in the Krebs cycle. So it replenishes it for the Krebs cycle, and it's necessary to make new glucose, to make for gluconeogenesis. It's a magnesium-dependent process. Then we have acetyl-CoA carboxylase, which forms malonyl-CoA from acetate. That's also part of the Krebs cycle, the energy cycle, and it takes the acetate and puts them into fatty acid synthesis, and it requires magnesium also. Propionyl-CoA carboxylase, see, they're all carboxylases. We could have left that word off, but for completeness sake, we put it in. Converts the propionyl-CoA to methylmalonyl-CoA, which is important for the breakdown of isoleucine, methionine, and threonine. You may recognize the word methylmalonyl-CoA if you're familiar with methylmalonic acid, which is a test that you can do to see if B12 status is intact. And you can go into the B12 topic and learn about that. This is related to gluconeogenesis in the liver, so you can form glucose from pyruvate. So gluconeogenesis, as a reminder, the gluconeogenesis is the process from which you make new glucose from something that is not glucose currently. So gluconeogenesis can make new glucose from glycogen. So glycogen is a starch basically stored in the liver or the muscles. Or you can make new glucose from amino acids or from, say, leucine, isoleucine, and valine. Those are the branch chain amino acids. Or you can make new glucose from muscle, basically. So that's the way you do that. So the gluconeogenesis happens in the liver. So you take in the glycogen, forming it into glucose, and it requires this biotin. But you see, many of them require magnesium as well, and this one requires B12 to do. So if someone is deficient in magnesium or B12, making new glucose from the store is going to be a challenge. So then we have beta-methylcrotonyl-CoA carboxylase. These are mouthfuls. Those of you who have been trained or studied Latin or any of those languages might say these a lot better, but they're challenging words to say. They're mouthfuls. It's easy to stumble. Converts beta-methylcrotonyl-CoA into beta-methylglucanyl-CoA. And that allows the breakdown, the catabolism is breakdown of leucine and certain other compounds that requires magnesium. So you can see that these are all in, they're basically involved in metabolism and energy production. And that's what we started out. We said that biotin was related to hair and metabolism. So you can see how at this point. Just a picture, you know, we've got a little close-up there of the part of the Krebs cycle. And so this is gluconeogenesis, and this is a picture of the pyruvate carboxylase and acetyl-CoA carboxylase. And you can see that the lipogenesis and the gluconeogenesis. And again, just to see you and give you pictorial stuff, acetyl-CoA carboxylase 1 and carboxylase 2 related to glycolysis, fatty acid oxidation, and fatty acid synthesis. So all these are related to metabolism and energy production. And here's one where it's the metabolism of the branch chain amino acids, like I said before, isoleucine, leucine, and valine, and they can be converted into energy. And this is the process, and this is where the little boxes, the colored boxes, are where the biotin comes in helping that conversion. And then finally, we've got the propionyl-CoA carboxylase in the metabolism of methionine and threonine. And we know that this is a really important cycle. You might recognize this up here as part of the methylation pathway, and it's the conversion of homocysteine to methionine, right? So there's a lot of stuff that happens in between and down through the middle, which we looked at when we looked at methylation, is specifically in regards to vitamin B12 and folate. And over here in this pathway, this homocysteine, in order to get converted to methionine, needs the B12 and the B9, the folate. So we could see down here the breakdown of the homocysteine into cystathionine and then alpha-ketobutyrate and then down into propionyl-CoA and all the way down into energy and putting it into the citric acid cycle, biotin dependent. So sometimes, you know, we get a buildup of homocysteine, and that we know is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease and also neurodegeneration. And so that homocysteine can be elevated because we lack B12 and folate over here, we lack B6 here, but also if we lack the biotin down here. And it might even be related to magnesium because this is dependent on the magnesium as well. So you can see this is complicated. And so you can't just have this for that in nutrition. Same way you don't want this for that when you're looking at traditional or conventional type medicine where this drug for that presentation. Because if you just think about this nutrient for that presentation, you're not taking into account all these amazing interactions that happen. So the bottom line is you start with food. It all starts with food, and it starts with whole foods that are brimming with nutrition. And then when you look at where people are getting blocked in these pathways based on the symptom presentation that they have, then you can look at like what particular nutrients do you need to give in larger amounts. Bees are off, it's just really good to practice to give a B complex whenever you're giving an individual B because of all these interactions. So if we're seeing that we really think that biotin is a serious deficiency, we would be best to give them a B complex along with extra biotin. And the company Thorn actually has a lot of formulations that are based on that philosophy. They have like B complex, basic B complex, and then they have B complex number 6, they have B complex number 3, B complex number 2, B complex number 1, where they'll have the B complex as the core, and then they add the extra of that nutrient that you're trying to increase in the person. So let's look specifically, now let's make this clinical, okay? Let's look at the actions that biotin takes in the body. Well, we saw that it's really important for converting food to glucose and producing fatty acids and amino acids. We saw that in those pathways we just looked at. Oh, it's important for activating protein and amino acid metabolism in the hair roots and fingernails. So all that stuff we just looked at where it's important for the synthesis of proteins is it happens in the hair roots. And when biotin is missing, we're not getting that synthesis in the hair root. We don't have enough protein to create hair. And so we don't replace the hair that's falling out every day. Contrary to popular belief, hair loss is normal. We constantly lose hair, we constantly lose eyelashes, we lose eyebrow hair, and it gets replaced. So there's always going to be little peach fuzz coming in at the top and some older hair that's lost. But if there's problems in the roots, you're going to lose some of that hair prematurely because the root cannot sustain continued growth of the hair. And you're also not going to produce as much. And you'll see some of the pictures of biotin-related hair loss, and it can be pretty gruesome. So because it converts glucose to ATP, biotin's important in energy. So if you've got somebody who's very tired, you want to be putting in some biotin. I recently ran a test, an oat test on someone who's having a lot of energy issues, and biotin was one of the nutrients that showed up low because of the pathways, when we look at the pathways that were deficient. So we're putting her on the biotin to help her with her energy, along with things like CoQ10 and some of the other B vitamins. DNA replication and transcription. What does that mean? Well, DNA replication is critical for every cell in the body. We need to be able to replicate the DNA and then transcribe in order to promote the production of the proteins that that DNA codes for. So the role that biotin has here is related to histone binding. And I don't know if you remember the picture we looked at back when we looked at some of the, in one of the modules where we looked at histone binding, it's one of the pieces where we're replacing and where some of the damage can happen when there's some SNPs. It's related to genetic expression. So if you can't transcribe and translate the DNA and create the messenger from the messenger RNA, you can't make the proteins in the cells. And so things suffer. So that's why biotin tends to be related to hair and skin and energy, of course. Has an effect on cell growth and metabolism. So when you're seeing somebody who's, you know, wounds don't heal that quickly, it could be related to biotin. Maintenance of normal skin and mucous membranes. So where are the mucous membranes? Well, we have them in the mouth, we have them in the lungs, we have them in the gut, we have them in the vagina. Those are all mucous membranes and they have to remain moist. It's related to nervous system function, again, because it's so involved with the metabolism and production of energy. How can you have good nervous system function if your energy levels are subpar? And finally, of course, hair, which is what biotin is known for in popular press and its general normal physiologic function. So you can see that biotin is a super important vitamin, B vitamin, and it doesn't really get a whole lot of press. You know, it's known as the hair vitamin, right? People don't know biotin. They know vitamin B6. They know, you know, B12. But biotin doesn't get a lot of popularity. It's kind of like the cousin that's not so, you know, not so touted in the background, but it's like the silently doing all this amazing work. So let's look at biotin deficiency symptoms. Well, it's obvious that we would see somebody tired, lethargic, fatigued, exhausted. They're different strengths, so to speak. There's different manifestations of the same thing. You could be tired, you could be exhausted, you could be lethargic, you could be fatigued. Alopecia is hair loss. And so we see in this picture here that there's a big spot of hair loss. Now, do we know for sure that this person had a biotin deficiency? No, it's a good picture. And it can look like that. You can see she's got the hair pushed up and over. Her hair would then come down normally and cover it. And a lot of times people have this pattern of hair loss. You don't even know they do because the hair on either side of it grows over it. Okay, it's unlike, you know, male pattern baldness where it's just up at the top and there is no hair to cover it up because it's all at the top. This can happen anywhere on the head. Sometimes it's associated with the loss of hair color. So if that hair turns kind of white, especially if the person happens to be young and it's falling out, then we should be suspicious of a biotin deficiency. It can cause a rash, especially around the mouth, eyes, nose, and it's usually a scaly kind of a red rash. So if you're seeing people with this rash and you're not sure what it is, the biotin is certainly a possibility. You know, nausea, depression, these are things that happen in so many conditions. But if you've got that combination of nausea, depression, and hair loss, then, you know, really start to think biotin. Hallucinations as well. And again, there are quite a number of neurologic issues that can create and psychiatric issues that create hallucinations. But again, when you're looking at a composite, if a person has hallucinations and none of these other symptoms, you're not necessarily thinking biotin. But if they've got hallucinations and depression and this hair loss and they're exhausted and they have muscle pain, you might be thinking biotin. Paresthesias in the arms and legs can be related. Paresthesias, as you recall, is that loss, that sensation, that's the numbness, the tingling is called paresthesia. And we know that in vitamin B12 deficiency, we see what's called stocking and glove paresthesia, the fingers, the hands, and the toes and the feet. But the paresthesia in biotin is a little bit different in location in that it can be related to the arms and the legs. Now, paresthesias have a lot of different causes. So again, if it's paresthesia in the absence of a lot of this other stuff, it may or may not be biotin. Paresthesia can be caused by nerve compression. And that, you know, there's certain patterns of nerve compression that will cause certain patterns, certain locations of the paresthesias. So it's just giving you an idea of all the different ways that biotin can manifest. Well, what are some of the risk factors for biotin deficiency? We've already discussed that eating raw eggs is a big one. I've already mentioned that hypochlorhydria, low stomach acid, can contribute to low protein digestion and absorption because we're not making enough stomach acid, because most of the biotin in food is going to be bound to a protein. We talked about anticonvulsant drug use. We talked about alcoholism, but inflammatory bowel disease. We talked about leaky gut, but also things like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or a diverticulitis. Any kind of inflammatory bowel disease can impact the transport, the active transport of the biotin into the system. Pregnancy, right? We talked about that as well. And then genetic defects, smoking, and we didn't mention is liver cirrhosis. So a backup in the liver can affect biotin deficiency as well. So a lot of things can impact biotin. Let's look at some particular conditions that you might see. Biotin and diabetes. So biotin is related to blood sugar control. And there have been some studies where they took people with type 2 diabetes and put them on biotin. The fallacy with a lot of these studies that are not necessarily conclusive or inconclusive when they do them is that they usually use isolated nutrients. And we know that these are multifactorial. So just because they give someone with type 2 diabetes biotin and they don't see an improvement doesn't mean that the biotin wasn't doing a lot of good. It just means that biotin wasn't the whole picture, right? So that's the fallacy when we try to do these double-blind placebo-controlled studies. They do it in a reductionistic manner. And really, nutrition is a holistic process, and there's interactions between them. And just because you give somebody one particular nutrient and it doesn't improve a condition doesn't mean it's not useful. It just means that it's probably not the whole picture. Biotin actually increases the utilization of glucose for fat synthesis. Remember, we looked at that, the carboxylase is required for fatty acid synthesis, and that can be helpful in diabetes control as well. It stimulates an enzyme called glucokinase, which is a liver enzyme that increases the synthesis of glycogen. So if we're going to increase the synthesis of glycogen, it's going to increase the clearance of glucose from the blood so that the glycogen can be controlled. So that's one of the other mechanisms. And also it can trigger the secretion of insulin, and it did this in a rat study, and improve the glucose homeostasis. So if there's more insulin, then it can improve that. But it depends. You know, if we're dealing with somebody who's insulin resistant and they're overproducing insulin, something that increases the secretion of insulin is not necessarily good. And you can go and look at these studies. I've given you a link there. Biotin is related to the fingernails as well as the hair and the skin. So they've tried giving animals that had hoof abnormalities biotin and had some effect. Studies show that 25% increase in the thickness of the nail plate in patients supplemented with biotin for 6 to 15 months. And again, nails, right? It's not just biotin, but biotin can be in combination. It could be zinc, it could be protein, it could be hypochlorhydria. A lot of things are going to affect the nail synthesis, collagen. And then the study found that supplementation of 5 milligrams a day was effective in controlling a condition called uncombable hair syndrome, which is an inherited condition. So it was basically in two toddlers, but I thought, interesting kind of a study. So biotin and hair loss, it's a symptom of severe biotin deficiency. And we saw earlier a more of a big patch, but this is also a way that it looks as well. It's just, you know, where the hair is very thin at the scalp and there's sections where the hair just isn't growing. Because the biotin improves the keratin infrastructure, which is a protein that makes up the hair, skin, and nails, that makes it imperative to have good hair, skin, and nails. You need the biotin. Biotin administration is found to reverse alopecia in children. That as a result of taking the anticonvulsant drug valproic acid, it causes hair loss. And then when they administered biotin to these kids, it reversed it. So these are all some of the evidence. I mean, there's a whole lot more, and you can just study this to your heart's content. I've given you one link there. So here's the problem with the basal ganglia, which is part of the brain, and you'll see it's kind of a small picture, and when you print out your slides, you can see that much larger. When somebody has basal ganglia disease, it's often called thiamine metabolism dysfunction syndrome 2, and it's caused by mutations in a gene that encodes for the thiamine transporter 2, THTR-2. I haven't looked to see if that's actually given in the 23andMe test. But in any case, when you're looking up genes, just as an aside, you can go to Google and you can type in THTR-2, and then you can say space RSID, or you can say space, you know, SNP, or there's a bunch of different ways you can do it, and that will show up. And there's places like Snipedia, GeneWise, there's a bunch of different sites now, and also some Medline studies where they're really looking very, very closely at the genetic abnormalities. The clinical features of this basal ganglia disease usually occur at around 3 to 4 years of age. It's basically subacute encephalopathy, and it's a pathology in the brain that can cause confusion, drowsiness, and altered level of consciousness. It also can cause ataxia, which is altered gait, right? You can look at ataxia when you look at a drunken gait. You know, it's just like you're not getting the feedback from the legs to the cerebellum to control the gait, and so it's a stumbling kind of drunken man's gait, and it can also cause seizures. There was one retrospective study where biotin supplementation at about 5 to 10 milligrams per kilogram abolished clinical manifestations. A third of the patients suffered from recurrent acute crises, but the acute crises weren't observed after they also added the thiamine supplementation. So we started out by saying this is a thiamine metabolism dysfunction syndrome. So it's a combination of biotin and thiamine in this particular case, where thiamine was given at pretty high doses, 300 to 400 milligrams a day. And that along with the biotin helped these kids from not having recurrences of the disease. So when they took these kids and they looked at them, they analyzed it, they figured it out early, and then they immediately started treating with the biotin and the thiamine, they had really positive outcomes. And you can look at that particular study if you're interested in that. Biotin also is related to birth defects. And so at least a third of women develop marginal biotin deficiency during pregnancy. Remember we said earlier that biotin absorption is affected by pregnancy, that they need more, the biotin need goes up. When women are not given the extra biotin or eating extra biotin-rich foods, or if they're drinking egg yolks because doctor says they need more protein, they can be having a biotin deficiency, an accelerated biotin deficiency, and it's been found to cause some cleft palate and even limb hypoplasia, where it's like underdevelopment of the limbs. Biotin depletion suppresses the expression of one of the carboxylases, there's four of them, and it removes the biotin markers from histones and decreases proliferation in human embryonic cells, the palatal mesenchymal cells. So when they do that in culture, they see that there's a disruption there of the cells that make up the palate. And if that's happening in utero, we have a lot of kids that are born that way. And it's a problem, not just, you know, cosmetically, it can be repaired, there'll be a scar, but the biggest problem is that it affects the palate, which can affect their ability to suckle and get nutrition. So when they suckle, when they've got this cleft palate, they can't get a little suction on the nipple to get the food in, plus you get a leakage of the milk that gets absorbed, that gets sucked in up into the nose. So there's a lot of problems with there, and they can aspirate it and they can have serious problems. So it's not a fun disease, and usually people are given a surgery to repair it. So again, like I said, it's not just cosmetically, it's functional. So impaired carboxylase activity related to the biotin deficiency can result in alterations in the lipids. Remember we said that there was involved with the synthesis of lipids, the fatty acid synthesis, and that's been linked to cleft palate and skeletal abnormalities. And biotin deficiency can lead to reduced histone at specific genomic loci and possibly increase the instability and result in chromosome abnormalities. So kids that are born with malformations, and there's a link there. So let's look at biotin in multiple sclerosis. Unfortunately, multiple sclerosis is increasing. It's on the rise. And I think a lot of it has to do, it's autoimmune, and we've got a huge prevalence of gut flora problems. We've got people who are eating oxidized fats. They're not really getting the food and nutrition that they need to prevent the breakdown, the damage, the attack from the body, from autoimmunity on the myelin sheaths. So the progressive degeneration of the neurons can also be related to a decrease in ATP, so that the myelin sheaths are not able to repair and to grow the way they need to because of it could be related to the biotin. A lot of things are related to mitochondrial dysfunction, but certainly the biotin can be one of them. So MS has been associated with problems with the Krebs cycle, with the ability to make energy. So there's some studies, a non-randomized pilot study, 23 patients with progressive MS were given between 100 and 600 milligrams a day of biotin. I know that's a huge range. And they had sustained clinical improvement in 5 out of 5 of them. 5 out of 5 that had progressive visual loss. And then 16 out of 18 that had partial paralysis. That's huge. Right? That's a huge number of folks. So out of the 23 people, we're looking at 21 of them that had huge success. So I would say that that is definitely worthwhile in people with MS. There was a multi-center randomized placebo-controlled trial in 154 patients with the progressive MS. 13 out of 103 improved on 300 milligrams of biotin for 48 weeks compared to none in the placebo group. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot. And I don't know if they went back and tried it with larger quantities or if this was done alone. That's the other thing you can't know. Like, if you're just giving somebody biotin, it may not improve them overall, because if you're not giving them the fatty acids, you're not getting them off of gluten, you're not getting them into the nutrients, other B vitamins, the phospholipids, and all the other things that are required. So let us look at things that deplete biotin. We've looked at that before. Long-term use of antibiotics can deplete biotin-producing intestinal microflora. So we talked about that before. It's really important that if somebody's on antibiotics, that maybe looking at things to make sure they're on a good B vitamin along with it. High doses of pantothenic acid, the use of parenteral nutrition for a long period of time. And parenteral nutrition is scary. I mean, it's kind of when people are fed, like tube fed, they're fed IV, and we're expecting that you can give them everything they need. And we don't know everything they need and the right amount. So it's basically, you know, man is going in there and saying, okay, this is what we need. And a lot of times with the parenteral nutrition, they leave out certain nutrients, which is kind of scary. Alcohol, we talked about that earlier, certain orders of absorption. So leaky gut, Crohn's disease, any of the absorption problems, GI disorders, and pregnancy. So these are all the things that deplete biotin. That's just a review. What other nutrients interact? We talked about pantothenic acid. Large doses of pantothenic acid can compete with biotin for the uptake by a sodium-dependent multivitamin transporter. Alpha-lipoic acid also shares that human sodium-dependent multivitamin transporter with alpha-lipoic acid. And so pharmacological doses of alpha-lipoic acid, which is done a lot, like with things like insulin resistance with neurologic issues, it can be very helpful to do large doses of alpha-lipoic acid. But it's also to keep in mind that if you are doing that, that you want to make sure that you're giving them some extra biotin. So if you're giving them large doses of pantothenic acid or alpha-lipoic acid for any reason at all, you want to make sure that you're sufficiently nourishing them with the biotin. So adequate intake for biotin. Well, here's just a chart. Infants, it's a little tiny dose, 7 micrograms, but look at breastfeeding in pregnant women. They're up to 35 micrograms. So it just ranges and it increases as we age and get larger. It's usually related to size, not age. So some clinical uses of biotin, used for thinning of the hair, that red scaly rash around the eyes, nose, and mouth, nervous system symptoms. I mean, it doesn't have to be full-out MS, but tingling of the arms and legs versus tingling of the fingers and toes. You differentiate that because I'm more thinking of B12 when it's the fingers and toes. Depression, exhaustion, and hallucinations. So we had a list earlier in the presentation of all the symptoms of biotin. And usually you can say, well, these are the deficiency symptoms of biotin, so this is when it can be used. Definitely want to be supplementing with it in breastfeeding, but also kidney dialysis, you require extra biotin. So if you do have someone who's on kidney dialysis, you want to make sure that they're getting extra biotin. Biotin excess, we don't see much of it. It's safe, it's non-toxic. I haven't seen any studies associated with serious side effects, even in very large doses. So the FDA even reports that biotin is safe and well-tolerated, taken by mouth in recommended doses, but it's even been shown to be safe when it's in higher than recommended doses. So let's look at clinical assessment. I love being able to assess. There's several ways that you can do it. In the urine, If you look at biotin in the urine, and biosorbin is an early and sensitive indicator. So you can check their urine and see if they're low in their excretion of biotin or a particular metabolite by bisnorbiotin. Increased urinary excretion of a particular metabolite called 3-hydroxyisovaleric acid is a leucine metabolite. And I think this is measured in the OAT test as a marker for biotin. It's excreted in increased quantities when the biotin-dependent enzyme is deficient. So this is one where when you see an elevation in this 3-HIA, and again, like I said, it's done in the OAT test, then you're suspicious that there's low biotin. And in a client I looked at recently that I was telling you about earlier, who had a lot of fatigue, we found a lot of these Krebs cycle problems, and biotin was one of the nutrients that we decided to supplement because of this issue. She had this elevation in the 3-HIA. Serum and plasma are not that valuable. It's mostly in the free form, and it's harder to test, but really we don't use that as a marker of biotin. Usually want to use a functional assessment, and the urinary excretion of 3-HIA is probably the best one. So where do we find it? Interestingly enough, on the animal source side, egg yolk is a good source of biotin, but egg white inhibits it. So interesting, because nature does that sort of stuff, right? It provides you with this balance. So if people are eating the egg whites and throwing away the yolks because they're concerned about cholesterol for whatever reason, or they want the protein and not the fat, then they can be creating a problem with biotin, whereas they're throwing away the yolk, which has it. Liver is always a good source of most nutrients that are stored, so liver, kidney, and yeast are good sources of biotin on the animal side, but the regular meat is not, because it just doesn't get made and synthesized by the animals and stored in the muscle. On the plant side, we've got a lot of great sources: nuts, tomatoes, onions, carrots, romaine lettuce, cauliflower, soybeans. So all of these are really good sources of biotin. And we'll look at a chart that shows you specific amounts. And you can go to this whfoods.com, and there's a good one on biotin. So you can see if the amount that we're looking at is somewhere in the 30 milligrams a day, a quarter cup of peanuts, which is, I'm not a real fan of eating peanuts just because they have aflatoxin and they're not that easily absorbed. But you can see that just a quarter cup of those peanuts can provide 88% of the recommended amount. Tomatoes, not as good. The tomatoes are 7.2 micrograms, which is 24%, but that's just in a cup of tomatoes. And so if you're eating a lot of tomato sauce and salsa and other things, you can certainly get that. A quarter cup of almonds has 14, so that's a good source as well. Not as good a source as peanuts. And you got to be careful if you have too much of the almonds that you run into an omega-6 imbalance, a dominance. And so we've listed those, and you can look at the chart, and you can always go to the site. And if you're helping people, one of the things that's really good to know and have access to these charts is to be able to help them in terms of putting to their menu plans and also some of the recipes. You can be looking at, well, I think they're deficient in biotin. How can I up that biotin? Where can I add it? And sometimes you can just add little bits of these foods to certain kinds of dishes and really up the nutrient content. And that's true of biotin as well as just about all the nutrients. There are a few herbs that are high in biotin: alfalfa, burdock, chlorella, and dandelion. And guess what? These are all good for the liver as well. So they're going to help the liver support, and maybe that's why they're good with biotin, but they actually have good amounts of biotin. And maybe that's why they're good liver support, because of all the biotin that's in them. But those are good foods in general. So how do we supplement? Well, you can get a single nutrient supplementation in various doses. It's usually in a B complex and in a multivitamin mineral. Many of the multivitamin minerals have 30 micrograms. And I think I might have said on the other chart 30 milligrams. We're talking micrograms. And it's sold under a bunch of different names: a Purex, vitamin B7, vitamin H, biotina, biotin, coenzyme R. Mostly it's going to be seen as biotin. That's generally the way you're going to see it, maybe in other countries. And then we have references. So there's a lot of different places where you can go to learn more. Our textbook, Advanced Nutrition and Human Metabolism, is a great place to go. And then there's a number of online sites where you can find some good resources related to biotin. And these slides are all on your page, so you can download them and you can take notes on them. And that's it for biotin. So I hope this was really helpful and useful for you, and we'll see you on the next nutrient.